Welcome to Hear Us Out, the podcast where we explore how sound and hearing shape the way we connect with the world. Today's guest is a guitarist who doesn't just play music. He builds entire soundscapes from a single acoustic instrument. Mike Dawes is widely regarded as one of the most creative and technically gifted fingerstyle guitarists in the world. His ability to weave melody, harmony, percussion, and texture into one performance is nothing short of extraordinary. Known for pushing the boundaries of what an acoustic guitar can do, Mike's music is as much about feeling and expression as it is about technique. His approach to sound is thoughtful, emotional, and often mind-blowing to witness live. Mike Dawes, welcome to Hear Us Out.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
It is our pleasure. How do you think about merging technical precision and emotional storytelling?
Yeah, it's a big question, I suppose. The technical stuff, I'm kind of a solo guitar performer. So what that entails essentially is being a massive perfectionist and not trusting anyone else with anything, which means I'll kind of sit on stage or stand on stage alone and try and play these kind of full band arrangements. And the consequence of that is that it is quite technical. So the technical stuff is really more of a means to an end, the end being not having to rely on any other human beings and trying to have full control over with that and trying to transmit all the emotional stuff directly through one human rather than jamming with a bunch of people. So it is inherently technical as a means to a musical and emotional end. But the music itself becomes this kind of deeply personal thing as a result, I suppose, because it is just kind of done from one individual through to the audience. So I wouldn't say the technical and emotional areas are linked inherently, other than it just being, you know, the more control one has through direct emotional messaging, the more technical it has to be to facilitate that, if that makes sense.
Yes. And you talk about wanting to have that control, but I've also heard you talk about the need to say, for example, trusting the front of house engineers and trusting the other professionals around you. How do you find that balance, especially if you're working with, say, a house engineer as opposed to your own person?
Well, unfortunately, there's only so much you can do by yourself. And there are constraints to that. And one of the constraints of that is budget, realistic logistical things. Mm-hmm. In an ideal world, I would have my own sound engineer and own lighting person and everything, all the different layers of a show at all times. Realistically, I get to do that sometimes and I don't get to do that other times. So an example being, I did a US headline tour earlier this year and it was house engineers for the whole tour. That's what was advanced. But the UK tour I did, I brought my own front of house engineer. Now, comparing that, doing the same show with those two different options, no disrespect to the house engineers, but when you have someone who knows your show and can bring their own consoles and tailor make everything that they're doing to the set, they know the musical of that. It is night and day. However, it's not using the house engineers is not going to leave a funny taste in anyone's mouth other than, you know, oh, man, I wish they'd given me more reverb for that one tiny bit of this one thing. It's stuff that 99% of people won't care about. And also there are instances where the house engineers will just be absolutely stellar. They'll be like a hungry young kid who wants to do this for a living and he takes it really seriously and he kills it. And honestly, you can be so surprised and it can be amazing. Rolling those dice is just part of live performance, and it's just another thing that's sort of you know, similar to being up there alone playing. You know, you might mess up, you might, you know, it's another thing that could go wrong. But honestly, like, that's kind of the thrill of doing it. That's kind of the thrill of live performance. That's why I like live performing so much, as opposed to doing the curated social media stuff. Yeah, it's I've kind of meandered a bit off the question there, but no,
that's okay.
You can. Like, it's easy to trust people when you're not actually that afraid of the consequences, because the consequences could be exciting. You know what I mean?
I was thinking of improv during live shows as something you put in when something goes wrong, you don't remember what you're supposed to do, or when something doesn't go the way it's supposed to do. But do you purposely leave any room for improvisation and purposely deviating from how the song is supposed to go, just for the fun of it, for the excitement of it?
I rarely do. And the reason I rarely do is, number one, the most songs that I play are in different guitar tunings. So what that means is the entire canvas is kind of different. So the improvisational capabilities that I have, just in terms of my own proficiency, is somewhat limited by the tuning I happen to be in, right? So some tunings are just like really, really engineered so well for, you know, certain aesthetic and that aesthetic I might not have the proficiency to be totally fluid in outside of the kind of paintings I'm creating within that framework. When there's a song that's in standard tuning or something, I can be a little bit more loose with it, just because, you know, there's a little bit of experience there. But honestly, the improvisational aspects in my shows are mainly crowd work, or just things that are unique to that situation. Changing up the set order, changing the structures, you know, ripping into a little quote unquote drum solo and riffing off an energy in the room, that kind of thing. But there isn't a lot of space for improvisation in what I'm doing, because I'm trying to play the bass, the harmony, the melody, the percussion all at once. And it's a little bit just like in my brain, a lot of the time I'm just going, the whole time, because I'm not Charlie Hunter. I'm not meandering from that much. However, I'd be lying if I said it was a skill set that I'm not keen to improve upon.
One of our questions to ask was going to be, is there something with the guitar that you feel like you're working on, that it's such a, call it a humbling instrument, and here you are known world over as a technical virtuoso. Where do you find challenges on that instrument?
The guitar is the second best instrument in the world. I love it so much, but it's designed with flaws. You know, it's designed with flaws that you can exploit. So the best instrument in the world for me is the piano, because it's just... there's one of every
linear.
Note. Yeah, it's linear.
I'm with you.
It makes sense, right? It makes sense. The guitar becomes a bit of a technical nightmare once you really start going into it. And the stuff that I'm learning more as I play, and especially as I record with microphones, when we're talking about the acoustic guitar here, is you hear its flaws in recorded performances. When, you know, a lot of my recordings I analyze forensically. And there's things that you discover as your ear develops over time. That's kind of what I'm interested in right now. Think characteristics about the acoustic guitar. For example, if you're hammering on a note, guitar players might not know this, but there's actually two notes generated. There's the note that you tend to know, the guitar picked note, but then there's also a note behind the note, a harmonic that's generated from how the string vibrates behind where your finger touches. So if I'm hammering onto the fifth fret, you hear the sound from what's above the fifth fret, you know, the string vibrating. But there's also a little like tick, 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 kind of odd sound. And this gets amplified on the acoustic guitar in particular when you're using microphones in the studio. Well, live, it doesn't really matter, because the guitar pickups are on one side, right? So the guitar pickups are picking up the correct note, but the mics pick up both. And that you can get these really interesting clashes. And in some songs I've done, I'm actually playing with those clashes and emphasizing those clashing harmonics and adding them into the composition. Or in some cases, I'm having to adjust my technique to get rid of them altogether. And I can go into so much detail about things like that. But that's the level of nerdery that I'm interested in right now. It's how can I manipulate the physics of wood and wire? You know, the physics of the acoustic guitar, it's something that my engineer and I have to really consider a lot when we record, and it affects how we record. Another thing is how the strings beyond the nut vibrate. Mm-hmm. After you've just done a big staccato kind of chord, bap, there's a little that kind of rings out that you hear under with the condensers, but you don't hear live. So that's why I have little pieces of foam shoved into my guitar in various places. This, again, I didn't think I'd get this nerdy with you guys, but
I'm fascinated,
but super
by this.
Detailed stuff. Yeah.
We've spoken with, we had a luthier on the show who, he runs a small shop out here in the States, and a lot of big name players play his guitars. With your guitars, you're using from a tiny shop in Germany, Kunst Guitars.
Yeah. That's that guy right behind me, one of those.
Yep, yeah. How much of a hand do you have in the actual construction, the wood, the, like you're talking about where you're stuffing foam within the guitar? Talk to us about the physical structure of your guitar and your influence on that.
Yeah. Well, so my main guitar is my signature Kunz, the unfortunately spelt C-U-N-T-Z. That's his name in Germany. Don't sell many guitars in America as a result of this name, but they're amazing guitars, and they're, you can actually see behind me. So this is one of my Kunzes. I have three of them, okay. And they're my signature guitars. And there's the first one that we made together was kind of informed by his design and his thoughts, because Andreas knows the genre of like more percussive kind of playing. So there's some things he's done with the bracing, and then future models, we've elaborated on that and come up with some more ideas together. One obvious, one big thing is that there's an additional brace on my signature models that does two things. It makes the guitar very, very slightly quieter, very slightly, mm-hmm. just by reducing a little bit of the vibration of the top. But it's in a position where I beat the hell out of the guitar and it's solid as a rock. So I've never had any problems with the guitar. I've done every gig I've ever done with one guitar, actually, since 2016, all over the world, every wow. continent except Antarctica, and it's never broken. It's like I always say, it used to be a tree, you know, it's strong.
Yeah,
when that's I'm playing incredible. With yeah, like playing with someone like Tommy Emmanuel, who just plays so hard with his right hand and a guitar pick, I'm trying to compete with that with fingers. I have to mm-hmm. beat the hell out of it. And so this guitar can take a beating. One thing that was my decision was to add one of these little scratch pads to it, which is this little kind of piece of spruce there. It's a little extra piece of untreated spruce. Same material as the top, but just untreated.
Now, is that glued on, or is that just a thicker piece of the top that's not thinned out?
It's an extra piece. It's not glued on. It's done with a kind of very special double-sided kind of tape. The only reason is that if... I mean, it could be glued on. The only reason it's tape is that if you really wanted to and you really got in there with like a fine spatula type thing, you could slowly wedge it off. Mm. I've never done that, never intend to, but that's something. And then there's obviously the pickups is the big thing that would have been my contribution to his build. And the actual radius and the size of the neck and the fretboard, that was very much specific for me.
And would he kind of shave that down as to... See, like, oh, it's good now. Nope, take a little more off.
Yeah. There's the first one was I had to send him very special dimensions with using like a caliper. Like, I wanted to have the exact same. I've had the exact same neck on all my guitars. Like, all the guitars that I've had made have the exact same dimensions, but they are handmade, so there's variations there. But you know, it's as close as possible to the same dimensions. So that was necessary. I don't want to pick up one guitar and then pick up another guitar and. This technical stuff that I was saying, you know, where the brain's going, remove any variable that could make you mess up. And one variable is the neck being a different shape.
You've talked about your guitar taking a beating or lack thereof, that it doesn't take a beating. What happens when you or your hand takes a beating? Does that ever happen?
Yeah, it does.
And what happens if you or your hand get injured or overly play it? What happens?
That's so funny. Yeah, I mean, well, the classic thing is if I break a nail. Because I don't know if you guys know, but I have long fingernails on one hand, and that's the finger picking. So I got a long thumbnail, and then these guys. In order to get those textures and those layers out, it assists with the tone, makes it get a much brighter sound. You know, if I break a nail, sometimes I joke and say it's okay, I've got four more. But realistically, there's breaks that are real show killers and breaks that don't really matter so much. So it depends where the break is. Obviously, I just carry on playing and hopefully the audience is none of the wiser, but it does make it harder for me to play the summer songs. There's certain songs where I need certain nails to get certain techniques out. Like one example would be right hand harmonics, where I'm jumping in there and getting like a ping kind of sound. You need essentially a guitar pick on this finger, i.e. my fingernail, to get that. Otherwise, I'm just going to miss it. Things like that are an issue. But I do take a beating, Michelle. I work hard. I sit in tight. I'm 6'3" and a bit, and I sit in these little plane seats, and then I'm jumping around on stage, and then I'm bent and then stretched, and then bent and then stretched. And you know, I tour so much that I'm definitely feeling it in the knees and in the lower back and all of this now. I'm 35. I'm not 25 now. So I feel a difference. But mainly, I think people are generally surprised that I actually pick and play very lightly, and I really let the PA system do the work. So a lot of what you'd think is really, really hard on the fingers really isn't. I'm really quite light with the playing. My fingers never get tired, or you know, well, for the long headline shows maybe, but there isn't a lot of damage to the hands. It's the nails maybe.
Do you intentionally play light to preserve your strength, or is it just a stylistic preference for you?
I think it's a little bit of both, actually. In the long shows, I'll never play consciously light, but I will play consciously not as crazy if I'm doing a long show on the loud bits, if that makes sense. You know, if I'm doing a little opening set for someone and it gets the last song, I'm doing a rock and roll ending. You know, it just, you know, let's go. But if it's the first show of a long tour, I'm not going to go all in, because the nails do get weaker. And all it takes is a little crack and then that and the next show, that's a problem. The most breaks I ever have are when I'm out with Tommy Emmanuel opening for him, because we play together and he has such a loud stage sound because his hearing isn't amazing. I think he was born with yellow fever or something like this. His hearing has been bad since birth.
I'm here on a job site with Tim, who owns his own electrical contracting business.
3 employees and 2 work trucks.
Tim traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance. We're positively here where he needs us most.
They sure are.
With step-by-step help on all his insurance needs, all for shockingly low rates.
Shockingly low, huh?
Just a little bit of electrician humour. Do you get it?
I got it.
You know, it feels like we have a real connection. All right, I'll stop.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
So his stage monitor level is very loud. My stage monitor level isn't that loud because I don't like risking feedback with all my pickups and stuff. I play with fingers, he plays with a pick. So, you know, I'm really trying to keep up with him. Yeah, and I inevitably break nails on those tours with him. That's the most nail-breaking, for sure.
Going back to where you were talking before about nerding out with the sound and the physics, you have, beyond just listening, do you have any sort of formal training within the physics of sound?
I don't know. I'm a nerd, okay? So, and I like problem solving, and I like details that matter to maybe 3 other people on planet Earth, you know, and the only bigger nerd than me in this world that I've ever met is my engineer and producer, Josh, who is a stupid level of nerd. So when we record together, you know, it's pretty intense. Like the things that we would consider wrong, no one would ever notice.
What would be an example?
I think like the kind of chirps and the harmonic stuff that I was describing earlier, like the note behind the note, which is a very natural sound of any acoustic instrument or any instrument, any stringed instrument in general, you know, and I'm listening to classic records that have acoustic guitar recordings that we've all heard, and I will wince at some, but no one else will hear that. It's just I'm honed into it because I've had to spend hours and hours and days forensically analyzing it on my own recordings. There's a fantastic tool by Isotope. It's a plugin called RX or whatever version, and it's a plugin that contains something called a spectral analyzer, which basically paints, you know, that is like, it paints the sound as sort of colors. And we started using it when I was mixing a live album because there was someone coughing in the audience. And we were able to go in and see this little splodge of purple in this spectral kind of information. And then we could erase that little splodge of purple. And then that erased the person coughing without really affecting the audio. So having like learned that language, you know, it's very nerdy, isn't it? But I start to hear things that would otherwise not be an issue just because I'm going in on that forensic level with Josh in the mixing stage.
Fascinating.
So actually, right now, I'm mixing a recording for a company called Audio Tree. I did like a live session with them. It's kind of like a tiny desk type thing. It's a little hard for me because we recorded it straight from just my pedal board. So we didn't really have a lot of control with microphones and things. And my reverb pedal we used live, but we're now having to mix around that. We can't remove the reverb to mix the guitar. So we're very limited in what we can do. So we're finding creative ways to make the guitar sound big and not make it sound too messy. Can't really edit because the reverb tail's there, it's baked in. So this is an interesting way of trying to come up with some new tricks and things in the mixing process. So, sorry, I'm getting even more nerdy about
it. No, this is what we want to hear this stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm giving away all the secrets now, but you'd be amazed at what you can do with the Isotope plugins.
We can't replicate it, so it's okay. We can.
Yeah, it's amazing. Josh Clark is a genius. And we use a lot of you know, multiband compression, a lot of crazy stuff, because the way that I'm playing the guitar, having all these layers, and we'll say, oh, can we turn the bass drum up? Can we turn the rhythm guitar down? It's like, well, no, because it's one.
It's all the same.
It's all the same thing. But we're learning how to actually do that with plugins and certain methods of recording, certain guitar pedals, things like this. So, you know, we are getting better at getting in there and tinkering around under the hood.
It's listening to you talk about this and just in terms of thinking about how the ear works and then trying to have technology to break that down to take out what visualize you don't
it.
Need.
You know, yeah, you literally yeah. visualize it.
It's like Photoshop, but much more advanced.
That's exactly it. Yeah, it's. I mean, it's
for frequencies.
Yeah, I mean, you guys probably know. Obviously, you have like Melodyne and the ability to when that came out and gave us the ability to manipulate polyphonic audio, like actually like tune the individual notes of the chord. You know, there's been an occasional moment where I've actually been able to use that successfully, because going back to what I was saying about the guitar being a technically imperfect instrument, it's never in tune. And playing in these big open tunings, you know, if you've got some open strings at the same time as some notes that are fretted quite high up the fretboard, the intonation could be quite terrible. And tools like that can help you just like make it a little bit more bearable, but still maintain its realism and its punk rock aesthetic. It's hard. Just solo acoustic guitar, recording it correctly is really damn hard. Really. It
sucks. Especially with what you're doing.
It sucks. Yeah.
I'm taking 20 steps back here.
I'm sorry, Michelle. I'm sorry.
I should have asked this towards the beginning, but I think of singers that have vocal coaches and professional dancers that have dance teachers. Were you taught this level of advanced guitar, or is this self-taught? How did you get to where you are? Because there's no one like you.
Oh, well, there is. There is plenty of people like me. You know, I do what I do. I make the tunes I make, and then I try and perform them to the best of my ability. And that's the same with a million people, right? I was at the coffee shop getting this just before I came on here, and there's a lovely man in this bakery, and he started talking about, you know, saying his dad was a fan actually, so it was kind of really sweet. But he was saying, how did you get to doing what you're doing? And I tried to come up with an analogy that would make sense, and I realized it's kind of like a tree. And when you're young, you start with a few little decisions, and you can go left or right, and you could do this or you could do this. And when you're in your 20s, everything seems quite safe because no decision is too far from the other decision. And it's quite easy to kind of branch back to that. But as you get older and older, the decision tree spreads out, and I've suddenly found myself over here having made these decisions, these left and right junctions. And now I'm looking at the possible decisions I could have made to be over here. And it seems so far away and so far removed. And I feel like the longer I'm on this path, the more kind of scary it is, and the more I have to be confident in decision making. And the decisions that I was largely making throughout my teens and 20s getting into this was the super nerdy stuff that I'm describing. Spending time working on details and getting into the nichest of the niche. And I think that's why you're saying things like, oh, there's no one like you. Maybe in the brain that might be true, but it's because of the specific decisions that have led there. And there wasn't really anyone teaching that. It was a lot of, like, you know, going on YouTube, finding a community of musicians, learning a little bit from this guy, learning a little bit from this guy, and mainly just spending time alone with the instrument and discovery. But I really do want to credit Josh, my engineer / producer, for being with me since the very beginning. And on the audio side, because obviously that's what you guys are interested in, like, we have learned how to do this together, like just from trial and error. And if you listen to my very first album, there's so much like string squeak on it, for example. And at the time, we weren't even listening for that. We were just trying, you know. And now, oh my gosh, you listen back, oh, we would have done so many things different. That's all wrong, you know. And the new album, which is called Galactic Acid, that's like we've done it, this is how it should have sounded from the beginning, you know. So it's really just the relationship with him, and together, just trial and error over years. That's really what it is. There's been no roadmap for how to do it on the audio side, just us figuring it out. And he's become quite a pillar of the community, and now lots of people fly to him and record with him because he's just the best. I'm flapping my gums. That's why. For the benefit of the tape.
We prefer
this
to
much
listen.
Coffee. Yeah. Yeah.
We prefer to be listening over talking. You had mentioned earlier about playing with Tommy Emmanuel. We've talked to other musicians. Like when we had Robert Randolph on, we asked him, how do you find space when you're playing with Eric Clapton or whoever it may be? And he's like, oh, I'm always stepping on toes. How do you find space when you and Tommy are playing and he's playing so loud and you're doing similar but different things? How do you musically find that road for yourself in those tunes?
I'm going to be honest. He does all the heavy lifting. like really. So Tommy is so good at not just playing guitar, but just he's such a good human. It really is conversational with him. He plays like who he is as a person, and he just wants to lift up everyone around them. And when he plays with me, he lifts me up in the way that he plays. So I play the arrangements that I've cooked. I'm like in the kitchen cooking something until it's ready, and then I'll present it. And when I present it, Tommy's there, and he will let the bits that I am gonna riff on pop out. He'll pop out over the bits that I do that are a little bit calmer. And over time, the show becomes pretty dynamic in that regard. If there's some kind of chaos, then it's our personalities that carry it through, I think. So an example being, you know, he was doing a show. He had Molly Tuttle opening, and it was in Bath, which is near where I live. And I went down to say hi. He invited me to jump up and play a song with him. As soon as we started, his preamp exploded. But then it becomes this kind of, you know, comedy duo, like, you know, thing with the audience, and we're getting this thing fixed. And then the energy of where to come back in and where to lift that show up from, like, okay, what's the energy in the room? What are we going to do? That becomes like our slightly extroverted personality types taking hold of a situation and going with it. And that's something which I think maybe it's because he's Australian and I'm English, we can do quite effectively. But in terms of like the guitar stuff, I feel like it's the Titanic and I'm just doing this at the front of the boat and Tommy's just holding on and just making sure I don't fall in. That's kind of how it feels with him. Yeah.
So you're really listening to each other. You're playing together as opposed to playing in parallel.
I mean, bro, I'm listening to him because he's loud as hell. I don't know if he can hear me. Genuinely, I don't know what he's hearing on stage of me. I don't know what he's getting in his wedge. But there are times in some venues as well, a little thing about live shows that people might not know is sometimes, I mean, what we hear on stage is very different from what the audience will hear. And it might sound like we're fully in sync, but it genuinely might be a situation of, I trust that you've got this. Watch my foot. I'm tapping my foot. That's the time, because we can't hear anything right now because it's just crazy up here. There's some shows that we've done in certain areas where it sounded very bad on stage just because of they've been, I'm not going to, you know, mention specific countries or specific parts of the world, but some places there's more control than others, right? And sometimes it sounds great, but, you know, I hear him. I don't know if he hears me, but I'm locked in with him, that's for sure.
We've heard that from a lot of musicians about how different the stage sound is versus what the audience is getting from
with
the
Tommy,
PA.
With Tommy, we don't use in-ear monitors, but when I work with Justin Hayward from the Moody Blues, the whole show's on in-ear monitors, so that's really easy. And some songs there's click. Some songs there's click, some songs there's not. And that's what's nice about that show, actually. A mix of different, you know, risks and safety nets and consistency and special. Oh, tonight we played this really fast. That was really cool. I like that.
So why not in ears versus a wedge with Tommy?
So I can't speak for Tommy, but
I mean, just for you, even if he's going with a wedge.
Yeah. So, okay. So first of all, there's carrying ears requires the crew to carry a little bit of extra gear, a little bit of extra infrastructure, transmitters and receivers and a little rack unit and things like that, which when you're doing, like in November, we're doing Norway, Czech Republic, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Hungary. All these are flying to these different countries. That's extra luggage. That's more stuff than we can carry in the vehicle. Things like that. That might be a thing. But personally, it's so preferable to have a wedge if you're just playing solo acoustic guitar, because you want to feel that air move. Like, I hate the sound of a DI'd acoustic guitar into my brain. It's not an enjoyable thing to listen to. I can understand in a band, it makes sense. But when it's just you on stage, I want to hear the room. I want to hear the audience. So when you wear in-ear monitors, you shut out the joy of what makes that evening unique. And it's just, it's too safe. Mm-hmm. I hate that. I want it to sound bad over there and great over there, and I want to run over and there'd be feedback and then we deal with it and then the audience say, oh, he dealt with that, that's cool. I want the danger. Mm-hmm. I want the bit in the show where I sit down and then it starts to feedback and I go whoops, and then I move the chair over there and then suddenly I'm there now, and I want to hear the laughter to the jokes and the, you know, I want to hear them cry when I want them to cry, you know. Good cry, not bad cry. It's just more fun. It's like, come on. It's like you're in the garage with your friends and you've got your Marshall cabinets. I want that, you know. I want to move air. Sorry, Michelle. The coffee is back.
You always want that level of danger, or did you reach a point in comfort in your career and profession that you were more comfortable entering that level of danger?
I think it's the second one. honestly. Yeah, I think so that's an interesting point, because when I started touring internationally, it was 2013, and this was a time before Instagram, long before TikTok. And if you wanted to be a professional musician, you wanted to earn a living doing music, which I did, you had to play shows. That was the only thing really available. You made music, you put it on the internet. There was not really any such thing as brand deals or podcasts, even in the way that they are, or anything. It's just you went out and played shows, got your fee, and sold some CDs. That's what it was. So I got so into that, and I dove in so much, touring 10 months of the year every year, like all over the world. But now, with the current generation of, you know, budding professional musicians, they're able to achieve their creative dreams and their maybe financial dreams as well without really having to leave their studio, because all these other tools and avenues are available to make a living through music. And that breeds a culture of safety, which is fine. It's great. Be safe. Like, why wouldn't you? But I'm already too far down the road of risk that now removing that and sticking me back here at home doing studio work is boring, because I've become addicted to the feeling of getting through that danger. Like, if there's an obstacle and you overcome it in front of a room full of people and you do a good job, I can pat myself on the back and have a great night's sleep, the best night's sleep I've ever had. But when I'm at home and I'm just second guessing every decision and making it super safe and doing a million takes, it's just a horrible, anxious mess.
Something could always be tweaked.
Exactly. Exactly. Something could always be tweaked, and you could always do something better. And oh, will they like it? Will they won't? I don't care. Play the song. Give it to them. Like, ram some culture down their throats. That's it. You know, that's what you get. And even if you mess up, no one cares. Like, dude, I don't want to mess up, but if I was a tightrope walker and I messed up, I would die. If I was a heart surgeon and I messed up, you would die. I'm a musician. Nothing happens. Like, it's fine.
So if a show goes too smoothly, is that less satisfying? If you don't have those moments of like, oh shit, I have to figure it out. Can you appreciate a just smooth and easy show that worked?
No, because it's never smooth in my head. That's the thing. It's always always scary to play the hard songs, and it's like, oh, this lick's cup, this section's coming up. It could be crazy, you know, and you get through it. So no, a good show is the best feeling in the world. Yeah, yeah. But I will say, it's learning to deal with the unpredictable things is a skill that you can only really get from excessive touring, and getting at peace with that has made my life a lot easier. Because there have been horrible things, like the PA explodes, or you know, you fall on the floor, fall on your ass, whatever it may be, you know. But it's how you deal with those things that makes or breaks the night.
You mentioned that there are certain places have more control over others in the positive sense. Have there been any specific venues that you've said, wow, this is one of my favorites to play at?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, there's just so many shows all over the place, but I do really like playing in America. Like, America's always been so kind to me, and I'm going to be doing a headline tour on the West Coast in late July. It's like late July. I'm starting in Seattle and going down through to just like Vegas. The American venues are run really well. The people they get in to do the sound, if it's house sound, they're always really, really eager and on time, and it's great. There's more notable, because generally everything's great, so it's hard to choose a specific thing that's good. It's much easier to just choose specific things that have not been good or surprisingly not good. Like, one of the most amazing looking concerts I've ever been a part of was the worst experience, you know, on stage. It was 5,000 people at the Odeon of Herod, I can't do the Greek words, the Acropolis in Athens in Greece. There's the actual temple, and then there's the actual many thousands of years old amphitheater there. And I played there backing up Justin Hayward and an entire symphony orchestra, and it was a full moon, and I'm there playing in this historic thing with this orchestra behind me, and I'm playing like Knights in White Satin, and I'm looking up at the actual Acropolis, the temple of Athena, under a full moon. And you know, it was just like, this is insane. But I had an in-ear monitor system, and I got like the spare of the spare in-ear monitor packs. And it was some like ex-Soviet like brick that was attached to my waist, pulling my pants down. And all I could hear for the whole show was just static, you know? Oh, so it was just absolutely winging it, sounded horrible, but then it was just like the most aesthetic thing. And then you see phone footage from what it actually was like out front. It sounded amazing, you know? And the Greek orchestra was amazing. But on stage, you're just like, I could be out of tune. I could be in the wrong. This could be awful. I have no idea. It was like terrifying.
But then I guess you make your way out of it and you hear how good it is. And that helps to build confidence, I would assume.
Yeah.
And you have a story to tell on a podcast.
I have a story to tell on a podcast. And also with something with that many musicians on stage, it's a lot less stressful than when it's just you on stage because everyone's looking at you and waiting for you to mess up. You
know? So with your style and when you're composing, has that become more efficient over time? So let's say a few years ago, 10 years ago, if you're breaking down a song to cover, when you would listen to the song, could you almost hear how you would play it, or would that take a lot of work, and has that gotten more efficient?
Yeah, that's a really good observation. Absolutely. So it used to be I was kind of flying blind, and now I've got these like rules that I kind of follow, starting with listening to a song and noticing if it will make a good guitar arrangement. And it's pretty easy to tell now because you have to learn. Yep, you have to learn the techniques that will facilitate this big polyphonic guitar experience. Once you've got the techniques, you can then hear, okay, I know how I'm going to play that part. I know how I'm going to play that part. And that really helps. And before you start trying to conquer this song, assuming it's a cover song, there's certain things that I like to follow. Like I love the tuning to work well in the key of the song. So I will try and, a classic example would be if the song's in D major or D minor, I'll use dadgad tuning, which is for the non-guitar players. It's basically tuning the guitar strings to notes that are very sympathetic to the key of that song, which means that, you know, if you hit an open string by mistake, it's probably going to sound good, which helps when you're flying all over the place. Now, I like to have a root and a fifth on the bottom two strings. So if it's in C, I'll have C and G. If it's in D, I'll have D and A. That way, if I need to get a power chord, I can do that with one finger. That frees up some other fingers. And I have four different registers typically to play with. You have the bass strings, the middle strings, the top strings, and then the harmonics. So I know if I'm layering different parts of an arrangement, say there's a bass guitar, a horn section, a vocal, and some little extra twinkly things, I could get those in usually at a maximum of four simultaneous frequency ranges.
That's it, just four?
Well, yeah. I mean, usually not all of those at the same time, but an example being, so I just did a Sleep Token cover, a cover of a band called Sleep Token. I'm actually going to see them on Saturday. And the interesting thing about that band is their singer, his vocal is very mid-range. It's not very, I mean, it's quite diverse, but in this particular song, it's quite, there are musical elements that are higher and musical elements that are lower than where his vocal sits. Typically, if there's like a female fronted song, the vocal usually sits high on top of everything else, right? Whereas this song, I knew that there were some sections where the vocal would be played on the top strings and some sections where the vocal would be played as harmonics. And actually at the end of the song, there's a melody that's played with harmonics, but the vocal is being hammered on in the mid-range because that's what feels right for the arrangement. So it's the thing that I've got better at over time, I think, is knowing which one of those kind of frequency bands to place the different elements in and still have it work as an effective arrangement and not sound too much like a salad. And I tend to go section by section. So I did a Everlong Foo Fighters cover, and that song is a pretty good example of how the percussion is arranged like a pop song. So section by section, I'm using different parts of the guitar to emphasize the percussive element. Everything from just a simple backbeat all the way through to a big wood kind of tom type sound. But it's pretty much section by section as if it was a pop song. So I'm trying to think more like a pop producer and make it sound good, not look good. You know, because a lot of players, and on my early album, I'm flying all over the place like, look, my hands are moving everywhere. Isn't that crazy? And you impress the man at the pub. Great. But it sounds like crap. So the trick is to try and just really make it sound good and use these little rules that you learn over time to try and facilitate that, I suppose. That's the goal. I'm still working on it, but that's the goal.
Does it lead you to be, I would say, hypercritical of your own work and also what you're listening to of others to try and dissect if it could fit your style or not, or if somebody else is doing the most they can with what they're performing? I feel like that question's a little all over the place, but it sounds to me like you're hearing music as chess, not checkers.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I think I'm getting better at seeing, like visualizing where an arrangement, again, we're talking about covers here, an arrangement will end up. And then the actual composing of that arrangement is just kind of facilitating the muscle memory, and there's not that much discovery happening in the moment. It's almost like planned out with a vision in mind, and then it's just executing that vision.
Okay.
There are things that will change. So I did an arrangement of a David Guetta song many years ago, and it started in dadgad tuning, but it ended up in C, G, D, G, B flat, C tuning. So very different, because I would reach certain parts of the song where I physically couldn't reach the note I wanted. So I had to then change the tuning so that this note became there and I could reach it. And then I had to go and relearn everything I just learned in this new tuning. And I did like four separate times.
So tedious.
Yeah. It's pretty tedious. But that was 10, 13 years ago or whatever. So now those kind of roadblocks are typically built into, I'm quicker at that now, quicker at imagining where it's gonna, if I'm gonna need to change anything kind of destructive. But arrangements are kind of easy because the song's written and all you need to do is really have the technical proficiency to do the things at once. And that's just practice. It's not really as creative as a composition once you've creatively established how to pull it off. The creative part is like, oh, if I do this, 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 and this with my fingers, I make this sound. Put that in the bank, and then you're pulling it out without even thinking about it. That's not the difficult part. The fun part's the journey to get that technical toolkit, and then the arranging of the thing is just work, really. It's just exercise. The compositions are what's really fun, because then you're painting with your toolkit, but you're so abstract you can just do anything. That's really fun. I'm again full of coffee right now.
Have you ever abandoned a cover because it just either didn't translate well on guitar, or whatever you were trying to do with it just wasn't working?
Absolutely.
Have you ever just given up?
Oh yeah, so many times. There's so many things that I've recorded and never released. There's things that I've written and never recorded, and there's things that I've written two-thirds of and then just given up on. I did a Dirty Loops song, and they're like an insanely technical trio of musicians, and I almost got it, but when I started listening back to my iPhone recordings of me playing it, I was just like, bro, you're leading with your eyes, not your ears. This doesn't sound good. And I was just like, you know what, you're right, I'm not going to release it, because it doesn't sound enjoyable to listen to. It sounds frantic. And I did a Maroon 5 cover. Like when I did my second album, I did a Maroon 5 cover on a baritone guitar that honestly, I was really proud of the arrangement, but just I tuned it in such a weird way where the tension on the guitar strings was very inconsistent. And as a result, it just sounded bad. Like the playing sounded fine and the arrangement sounded good, but the sound was just not right. So I abandoned it. Maybe I'll release it one day. It's literally recorded, but it just didn't sound like a fun thing to listen to. It's hard to describe. That's a nerdy sound thing. You know, if you got a really loose guitar string and then a really thick guitar string, tight guitar string, just you lose a lot of power in the sound, a lot of mid-range, and it just sounds a little just weak, amateur-y.
When you're thinking about compositions and whether it's working, not working, do you consider your audience in that? Or is it you need to really like it and be comfortable with it to put it out? Even if you think where it is, the audience will like it, even though you're not quite okay with it.
I'll never put anything out that I don't love and want to put out. Yeah, for sure. Like that would be silly. And honestly, I haven't really thought about the audience until recently. I very much consciously was just writing and releasing whatever I wanted without thinking about the audience at all. Like even talking about the covers, some people think that you would think that I would release covers that are popular songs. And that's not really ever been the goal. I mean, I've done covers of niche progressive metal songs. I'm wearing a Periphery t-shirt right now. They're a niche progressive metal band that I've done two Periphery covers, a Sleep Token song. I mean, arguably they're kind of one of the biggest bands in the world right now, but they weren't when I did the cover. It was a rapid rise. Somebody that I used to know, big song, but I did it because of a breakup. I didn't do it because it was a popular song. And it wasn't as popular when I did the cover, actually. John Mayer, Slow Dancing in the Burning Room. It became a guitar meme after I did that arrangement, actually. I just heard the song on the radio, didn't even know much John Mayer, and was like, yeah, okay, that sounds like it'll work as an arrangement, There's one song I did where I knew that it would be kick-ass for the audience, and that was I did a cover of One by Metallica. And the only reason I knew that would be sick for the audience is because that song is all about the climax, which is this rapid fire double bass metal shred fest. And I knew that when someone starts listening to that, they're going to be eager to hear, oh, I wonder what he's going to do with that bit. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I could keep their attention up to that bit. So that's the only time I've really made a decision that's been like, you know what? Yeah, that makes sense to do. you know.
While we're on covers, one of my favorites that you play is All Along the Watchtower.
Right, yeah.
How did you select the Black Sands Beach in Iceland for the video for that?
Well, yeah, I mean, so that's one of two Michael Hedges tributes that I've done. So Michael Hedges is kind of the guitar player who basically pioneered what could be associated with the style of acoustic guitar playing that I do, i.e. all at once, bishy-bashy everything all at once, but trying to hopefully make beautiful music out of it. I did a video in Iceland. So actually, my manager hit me up and said, hey, look, you can do a Tommy Emmanuel guitar camp. You can do one of two. You can either do the Nashville camp or the Iceland camp. And he goes, now, before you answer, the Nashville camp will be much better for your career because it's Nashville. Mm-hmm. Which one do you want to do? I was like, Iceland. Because I always wanted to go to Iceland. Grew up listening to crazy Scandinavian black metal bands, you know, that kind of landscape I always wanted to visit. So I went there for the guitar camp, but decided to stay a week and just be a tourist. And as part of that, do a music video on the Black Sands in Vik on the south coast, somewhere I'd always wanted to visit as a tourist, and thought like, hey, like I want to do a music video there. What would make sense? And out of all the songs that I needed a music video for, the All Along the Watchtower arrangement is very strummy. And that, I think, lends itself more to the, you know, the power of the Icelandic landscape. Whereas if I was going to do a delicate little finger-picking song, I don't think it would have been aesthetically appropriate to do it against a roaring ocean of gray, cold, freezing water.
It was so well done.
Well, thanks. Every shot in that video that we could use was used, because everything else was just Chinese tourists. Like literally outside of every shot, like here, Chinese tourists. There's one shot.
I was wondering how you got that. Yeah, where it's just you.
There was a giant semicircle of Chinese tourists just like looking at us like, what are you doing? And it was cold. It was so cold. The guitar got soaked. My hands got, and that's another thing. Like that arrangement isn't particularly like whittly. There's not a lot of like finger movement. It's lots of like big chords, and thank God, because I don't think I could have moved my fingers much more than they were moving. It was freezing. Yeah, the camera got soaked. Like, I got soaked. The guitar got soaked. It was, went under a waterfall. Not under, but the spray from the waterfall was destroying the camera. Yeah, it was rough. It was great.
And yet the guitar is still durable.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. Andreas Kunz guitars. He was pissed. He was pissed. It was pretty funny. Yeah.
So I'm so guilty of this, that when I go to concerts, I want to hear either the old time original music from that artist, or I want to hear the covers. How do you get people to gravitate towards your new stuff, your newer music, rather than just playing all the old stuff?
I mean, I honestly, it's funny. I've spent my career so far doing so many opening slots that a lot of the gigs that I've done, I'd say the majority of the gigs that I've done, were to largely people who would be discovering me for the first time. So they might not even know my discography. So there's no fear in worrying what to play. I want to play what grabs them in that short period of time that I have them. But for the headline stuff, I don't think it matters, honestly. I'm a big believer in just playing what you want to play. And I haven't really, you know, I've been enjoying opening with the opening track from the new record. That's been a fun thing to do recently. But I feel like another musician referred to me once as a moments guy. And I thought that was quite interesting. I feel like people come to my concerts because they've maybe seen or heard a moment, you know, like a particular tune or a particular cover, rather than, you know, obviously there's hardcore fans as well that know every single song. But I feel like people might come in this era of social media and YouTube and algorithms, people might know a song but not know what album it's from. Mm-hmm. You know, they might see something and think that it's new and it could have been released on my very first album. So I think nowadays, the way we consume media, the way media is handed to us by algorithms from tech companies, I don't think there's as much of a chronology in the zeitgeist. You know, I think people can come being like, oh, I hope he plays that Gautier cover. It was like, well, yeah, it was from his very first album like 13 years ago. You know, that might be why they're there, you know. And also, I've done so many concerts, I'd like to just do what I want to do. And then also hang out. I like hanging out with people if I can after the show and just create an atmosphere like this where it's just kind of hanging out. I don't want to have any kind of like wall of mystique or anything like that. So, and sometimes people will just yell a song and I'll try and play it.
One of the nice things of being a solo artist that you could just adapt as you go.
Yeah. You want. Watching Tommy on stage, it's like, you know, he's like, we don't need no stinking set list. He's like, I am the band, you know, it's like, it's great. But yeah, no,
probably freeing.
Yeah. I think there's less of a, to concisely answer your question, Michelle, I guess there's less of a pressure to be chronological because people don't consume music that way anymore, I think, largely. They're there for the moments and just try and give them the moments that are most likely to be the moments that brought them there. That'll be it.
One thing you do a lot in your shows is you will kind of teach what you're doing. You explain to the audience what your technique is and how you're creating the sound that you create. And then also you offer classes and instruction. Can you talk about the background to that a bit?
Got this guy. Boom. Where's that? Is that going to focus?
Your my camera class.
There we go. That's the one. Yeah. This is the golden thing right there. It's a little guitar in a box. These little guitars, people love these, man. So I had them made in these little gift boxes. They're USB sticks shaped like guitars. And on those USBs, there's about 9 hours of video lessons that teach all the techniques. And then there's a music book, much more. But yeah, lots of lessons. I think like when you're playing in venues, like not everyone is right at the front and not everyone can see what's going on. And even if they can see it, they might not be able to understand it. And I don't mean that in a patronizing way. I mean, there's just a lot going on and your eye could be over here when something's happening over here, especially with the percussion, because a lot of the percussion is a movement that is horizontally in towards the guitar. And just the angle of where the audience is, they might not be able to see the subtleties that are happening in the right hand. So yeah, I like explaining things like that. At the end of the day, I want my shows to be for everyone, not just the nerdy guitar player. I want the nerdy guitar players, you know, boyfriend or girlfriend who got dragged along to the show to have a good time and leave thinking, oh, I didn't think I'd enjoy that, but that was great. You know, I want the non-guitar players to enjoy the show as well, you know. So I think letting people in on the secrets is important. Yeah, I'm not trying to guard anything again, like I'm an open book, you know.
So what's coming up for you next? What are you working on that you're excited about?
Well, right now, so it's a bit of a weird one. I've been on tour all year since middle of January, and it's now the middle of June, really. And I'm home for about a month, which is great. About a month and a half, which I'm so happy about. I'm here in my little home studio in Bristol, England, and seeing family and all of that, which is great. But preparing for the next run, which is a headline tour on the west coast of America. So that starts on July the 24th and comes down and ends up at John Petrucci's Guitar Camp in Vegas. And then after that, I'll be doing a bunch of stuff with Justin Hayward from the Moody Blues. And then I'll be in November, I'll be back in Europe, both solo headlining. I'll be doing a solo German headline tour, which just got announced. And I'll be out with Tommy Emmanuel as well in the Baltic countries and all the cold places, you know, which will be a lot of fun. So a lot US solo, US Justin Hayward, UK Justin Hayward, Netherlands Justin Hayward, Germany and the rest of Europe solo and with Tommy Emmanuel. Those are the things. And then just releasing more music and collaborations. I've got some collaborations coming out with some really interesting musicians. And that's where the passion is right now. It's working with others. I've done 3 albums and a live album of pretty much strictly solo. So I'm enjoying working with other people at the moment. So there's some exciting things to come that'll drop onto my my YouTubes and things like that in the coming months.
Is there anybody that you are still looking to collaborate with that you haven't just yet?
Of course. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. Everyone. I mean, that I'm honestly very excited to, well, I'm going to be releasing a track with two very talented musicians, a guy called Bernth and a guy called Charles Berthoud, who's a bass player. And we've done like a shred acoustic guitar and bass kind of hyper mega thing. I'm going to be working with one of my favorite bands, actually. I'm not going to name who they are because I'm not 100% sure what's going to happen. But if it does, it'll come out in like November. They're like a synth wave kind of synth pop kind of band. Obviously, collaborating with Justin Hayward and Tommy Emmanuel has been amazing. Tommy and I did an EP together, which is just a dream come true. I don't know, man. I mean, it's like anyone. I mean, I'd love to do something with like the nostalgic guitar heroes, like the guitar that I like doing things that will make the 15-year-old mic just explode. So collaborating with like Metallica or like, you know, John Petrucci or you know, things like that, kind of crazy. Yeah, I don't know, man.
Anything's possible.
Silly answer. I mean, yeah, exactly. It's anyone. I just like playing. I like playing with people. So yeah, it's a really dumb answer. I'm gonna say John Petrucci from Dream Theater because I'm gonna see him at this guitar camp. So maybe I'll plant the seeds.
Cool. I'll make it happen.
Get a little guest feature on a Dream Theater record. That sounds pretty good. Yeah, some kind of a. Oh, actually, Jordan Rudess. I know Jordan. The keyboard player from Dream Theater. He's also a great guitar player. And I'd love to do something with him. That would be really musically interesting because he's a wizard. And I feel like that'll be another case of him making me sound good by his musical choices. So that'll be fun, yeah. Jordan Rudess from Dream Theater. Let's do it.
I have two last questions for you. The first is, I think, more personal. I don't think there's anybody better to ask any advice to get better at an F chord.
Wow.
It's been 7 years of miserably failing at the F chord.
The bar chord, the E-shaped bar chord, right? Yeah, the big boy. You know what? It's like, okay, so the action of the guitar and your position of your thumb, you know, make sure you're squeezing effectively. Honestly, like, the action might be the big thing. Like, I have a very low action on my guitar, and it makes everything much easier.
Eric hand-built me a guitar just for the purpose of me being able to get the F chord a little bit better.
That's so funny. What guitar do you have? Or is it it's just a custom?
I built it.
Nice.
From scratch.
Yeah.
That's very cool. Well, yeah, I mean...
Tried to make a thin neck.
Yeah. I mean, something about it, because I've taught guitar quite a lot as well. The position of the thumb is that's like your leverage. That's what you're squeezing into. And your wrist, like if your wrist's like this, you're not really getting any power. But if your wrist is straight, you're going to get a lot more power into what you can squeeze into. So keep your wrist straight, thumb in the center of the neck, and really give it the beans.
I'll do anything.
Just keep trying.
I'll do anything.
Keep trying. I could say more elaborate things like fan fret guitars. Fan fret guitars don't change that at all. No, you'll get it. You know what it is?
Thank you.
Practice.
Yeah. You're right.
You know what it is? You're right. It's Mike Dawes Master Collection Guitar Course. Available at MikeDawes.com. Exactly. I don't think I play a single F chord on that course, but there's a lot of all the other chords.
All the other techniques.
So maybe
that's
really the answer. Just avoid the chords.
Exactly. Just don't play it. Or you know what? Just play it differently. Play it learn the cage system voicings. So you play an F in many different ways. You don't need to play it with all six strings down there. You could play it an octave higher. You could, play it up on eight.
I use a lot of capos.
Yeah. Yeah, you could do that. It's capo in England. Yeah. Capo, capo. That's the whole thing.
We say the guitar brand differently there and here too.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, in Australia, it's very different. Yeah, much worse.
My real last question for you is that we like to ask people on the podcast if they've ever felt like they've become part of somebody else's story. So for us, we like to say with our patients that either we are making a big impact on them or they have a big impact on us. Have you ever felt like you have either affected somebody else, someone you've worked with, a fan, or they've affected or touched you in some way that stuck with you?
Yeah. I got some fan art once from someone and they posted it to my parents' house and they made my face look like that guy from the Goonies. That affected me because it made me want to vomit. But seriously, I mean, I would say the person that's had the biggest effect on me musically and spiritually is Tommy Emmanuel. The amount of shows we've done and just getting to see how he treats people just as a human is just as inspiring as watching him play guitar. And equally, I have a profound gratitude and appreciation to Justin Hayward. He brought me to America and I've been backing him up for 12 years on a couple of tours a year. And I feel blessed because I've essentially been mentored by one of the world's greatest songwriters, Justin Hayward, and like one of the world's greatest guitar players, Tommy Emmanuel, in tandem in this kind of like uncle, nephew, father, sonny kind of relationship, which is insane to think about. So I feel a lot of gratitude to both of them and anyone that's just taken the time to write a nice message or, you know, anyone that tags me in a story of like, their little kid jumping up and down listening to a tune or a message about them reconnecting with their dad, you know, things like that over guitar and learn, you know, all that kind of stuff is profound. And reflecting on that, even just by talking about that stuff with you guys, just like refreshes my motivation on those lazy, difficult days, of which there's a lot of self-doubt and a lot of anxiety, and it's not all fun. Because again, talking about that decision tree, like there's a lot of, you know, trepidation every day in choosing what to do in this weird musical world, in this weird creative world. So yeah, grateful for the nice words from people, you know, that they see the letter Z or Z, and I'm going through A, B, all that stuff in private, and to get a nice response for that, the letter Z is validating the whole journey. So yes, very, very grateful.
It's something I think the fans of music, fans of artists oftentimes overlook and forget that there is that human component. There is that self-doubt. That like, oh shit, do I sound good right now? Putting yourself out there to the world and hoping people like it. It's a very vulnerable thing that I think a lot of people just take for granted from the artist side of it.
100%. Yeah, it's It sucks. But when you're an individual, there's pros and cons. And sometimes I wish I could hide behind the brand of a band. You know,
it's not a team sport.
Exactly. It's not a team sport. So a mistake is on you. You say the wrong thing, it's on you. You play the wrong thing, it's on you. But you know, so is all the joy and the love and the good stuff. So, you know, someone, all the nice comments and all of that stuff, you know, but so is the criticism. So, you know, it's funny. Something that made me laugh recently is I did an interview with Rick Beato on his channel. And I was on tour and, you know, I turned up, we plugged in and I played a bit and hung out. But my reverb pedal is underneath my pedal board. And it was a very quick kind of thing. I couldn't see the knobs, but we plugged in my pedal board into his studio and I had quite a low level of kind of fallback, low level of like monitoring. But I didn't notice that my reverb, the knob had got knocked. So it was like maybe 20% like wetter and longer and bigger than I knew at the time. And we were playing and hanging out. And then I go and listen to it in the studio afterwards. Like, oh, wow, that's accidentally a little much reverb. Nothing you can do about it. Again, it's baked in. Whatever. Next. On to the next show. Whatever. Don't think much of it. Then it comes out and there's some people in the comments that are like, that reverb's the best thing I've ever heard. Oh my God, this guy's sound is amazing. And then there's some people that are just like, oh man, it's a bit too much. You know, and that just reminds you that, like, what, that's a classic example of, you can never please everyone, right?
Yep.
And the moment you start trying to do that, you're setting yourself up for failure. There's a story Tommy told me, a similar story of he played in Sweden for the first time and someone wrote a review of his show. And it was just like, it was a great show, but like, I just wish he'd slow down a bit. He's trying to play every note. He's trying to play so fast, trying to be all impressive. It's just too much. And so he remembered this. And when he went back the following year, he played a bit more of a few more softer things. And the same guy reviewed it as great show, but he just doesn't have the energy that he used to.
It's absurd.
I know. It's so funny. But yeah, you take on all that responsibility when you're the individual, but it's fun. You got to take both of it.
And I guess that's the benefit of you describing before of really playing for yourself as exactly. opposed to putting things out for the audience.
You can't
that
fail.
If you're doing it for you,
can't fail.
My last question for you is, how did you decide to play the Kunz guitars? How did you find that builder to play the instrument?
Well, I was searching around on the internet for something different and made a typo and they just came out. No, I'm joking. No.
I believed that.
Yeah. No, I discovered a musician called Petri Sariola on MySpace, became a huge fan, and a musician named Martin Harley from the UK, a blues musician who I opened for, my first ever gig I opened for him. Both of these guys were playing this Andreas Kunz guitars, and I ended up obviously becoming friends with them. They told me that every year he does a festival in his hometown in Germany, a little village, like 800 people come out and it's like just people playing his guitars, and got chatting about it. And he said he'd love to have me as like a special guest, even though I don't play his guitars, just come and be a special guest. And we played, we drank, we ate. And the next day I placed an order for a guitar, you know, because they're just amazing. And it's not something that I had access to try. But when I was there and I stayed in his workshop and saw how they were made, and the rest is history, really. I like art that's created by good people, and he's a great person. His family are great people, and that's why I'm always playing things made by people I know and listening to music made by generally people I know, and not listening to music from people that I think are douchebags. Yeah, I find it very hard to separate. I find it very hard to separate the art from the artist, actually, especially when it's an individual and not a band. So, yeah, as simple as that, really. He extended an invite. I visited and fell in love with his guitars.
It just worked.
Yeah, it just worked. Exactly.
So, and actually, just one more thing. What do you do to protect your hearing, given your career and your exposure to a lot of loud sound?
Well, you're going to hate this. I've actually really messed up or semi-messed up, I think, my hearing in one ear, because going back to talking about in-ear monitors, with Justin Hayward, when there's a band, since 2013, I've been performing with one ear in and one ear out. And that has, because I need to hear the room, and they don't have wedges. They don't. So I have to have my guitar in one ear and what I'm hearing, but then the room in the other. So I'll get a click just in one ear, things like that. And I feel I'm a little bit, my hearing isn't as good in this ear. I'm not deaf or anything, but it's not as good in this ear as a result. And all I really do is just get squidgy little earplugs when I go to a loud rock concert, but that's few and far between. I don't go to many loud concerts, and my concerts are quite quiet because it's just acoustic guitar. So, and noise cancelling headphones. and I'm listening to music and I'm just out and about, you know, things like that.
That's the way to go. So if I could just offer one suggestion, please. When it comes to monitors, for the ear that you typically take out, you can consider getting ones that have a filter in them. So it's attenuating less sound and it'll give you access to crowd noise and maybe hearing yourself a little bit differently to help where you're not exposed to the full stage sound.
Yeah, because mine are molded, so it's very much sealed.
They do custom ones with filters now too. So there's a lot of options to work around the things that artists don't like with their in-ears.
I'll try that. My ears are quite old. They're JH Audio, but they were done in 2013, you know.
Yeah, so there's definitely options.
I think I'll look into that for sure. I appreciate that.
And if you ever have questions, we're happy to help answer.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And we look forward to seeing you in New York in September.
Oh, nice. Yeah, with Justin. Is that the City Winery, right?
Yes.
Let me know. I'll get you guys on the guest list or something. You know.
Yeah.
Hit me up like a week before the show or something like that. And I think there's two shows there, so that'll be easy.
Back to back.
Nice one. Awesome.
And we'll get you some good musician plugs to have.
Yeah. Love that. Appreciate
it's
that, guys.
It's our favorite venue.
Oh yeah.
Yes. Yep. It's a nice place if you haven't been.
I have. Yeah. No. I did. I played there. The new location. It's down by the water, isn't it?
Yeah. Right on the water.
Yeah, I played in the upstairs solo, maybe like
the loft. I think.
And then I might be doing that solo. I'm putting together a tour, a headline tour for January, February 2026, and they want me there in the big room solo. But I have such a good relationship with the Iridium on Times Square. But I don't know, the booking agent's playing politics a little bit with that one. But with Justin, we'll be there at the City Winery for the two shows in September.
Awesome, and we'll see you there.
Nice. Looking forward to it. Appreciate you guys' time.
Fantastic.
It's been fun.
Mike, thank you very much. We really appreciate your time and coordinating this, and we'd love speaking with you and are big fans of your music.
I appreciate it. Thanks for your patience. I've been away so long, you know. It's hard to do these kind of calls.
Yeah.
It's hard to do it when on tour, so.
Yeah.
Watch out.
Well, thank you so much. We really, really appreciate your time and all your insight and your music.
Appreciate it. Thank you. And let me know if you need anything else. I'll see you in September.
Awesome. Thank you. Take care.